My name is Steve, and I just want to give our guests here a very, very warm welcome. If it's your first time, we're really happy to have you, and hope you're enriched by it today. So I've been here for 11 months now, and I don't know if these have been like the best 11 months or the worst 11 months of your life, but I enjoy it. So I've been here for 11 months now, and I remember on my third week, Johan, the gentleman who played piano, it was actually his first week here. And he told me a story that I'm allowed to share with you guys. He came here, and he's excited to, you know, go to a church. It was like his first Sunday. He's only been in the country for 2 days, and he goes to church on a Sunday. And he came in here in the morning, and he saw this Indian-looking worship leader. And he was so happy, you know, I'm from Dubai. I have someone kind of from home. I'm born in India. I have someone who I can, you know, maybe even look up to. Gosh. And maybe someone who can kind of remind him of home a bit. And, you know, if you know me, like, there's not that much Indian about me. I mean, I grew up here. I think after 2 minutes of talking to me, he realized, okay, this isn't right. And there is not that much. So my mom's from Trinidad, so she's West Indian. So there is West Indian inside of me. And, you know, I'm not really that, I don't enjoy Indian food so much. I know, that's kind of a weird one. I do like butter chicken. But I don't really enjoy Indian food so much. I can't stand the heat. I don't like cricket. I don't like Bollywood. I can't even barter, okay? I go to a flea market, and I pay whole price on everything. So I grew up in Etobicoke, and I moved to Burlington. And I didn't really have many friends who weren't, like, second-generation Canadian. And I didn't really know many people. Like, you can go to my high school, and you wouldn't find many people, like, you can't count on two hands more people than just Canadians, second-generation Canadians. But any traces of Indian in me kind of a little bit, like, kind of been phased out just a little bit. And this is what I want to talk about today. It's true that if we don't be intentional about practicing certain disciplines, then eventually these things start to fade themselves out of us. All right, so now, today we're going to be looking at Daniel, and we're continuing our series called Unshakable. Craig's away this week, and he asked me to speak. And I want to draw your attention to, on the screen here, we have a cell number. I don't know why it's shrunk. I'm sorry about that. But we have a cell number on there. I don't know if you can read it now, actually. 289-983-7819. And if you have any questions you want to text in, at the end of the sermon, I actually want to be able to address some of those questions. Back in Judaism, or the early church, they wouldn't do a sermon like this at all. In fact, it was a Greek thing that they adopt. You know, Greeks would speak, and that's actually where this whole idea of, like, the sermon comes from. Before that, it would actually be people actually discussing, so I want to actually open that door for you, that if you want to say something, I want to let your voice be heard. So do text in your question, please. So I want to call up Tim. I asked Tim to read the scripture passage for us. Tim, would you come up, please? You hear too much of me, go crazy. So I asked Tim to to read the scripture. We are reading out of Daniel chapter 1. So if you want to follow along, I know that this is a bit smaller than it should be. But if you have a Bible or a phone, we are reading from the NLT. Yep. In the mic. Yep. Hold on one sec. Dustin, can we turn this mic on, please?
Go for it. Okay. So during the third year of King Jehoiakim's reign in Judah, King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon came to Jerusalem and besieged it. The Lord gave him victory over King Jehoiakim of Judah and permitted him to take some of the sacred objects from the temple of God. So Nebuchadnezzar took them back to the land of Babylon and placed them in the treasure house of his god. Then the king ordered Ashpenaz, his chief of staff, to bring to the palace some of the young men of Judah's royal family and other noble families who had been brought to Babylon as captives. Select only strong, healthy, and good-looking young men, he said. Make sure they are well-versed in every branch of learning, are gifted with knowledge and good judgment, and are suited to serve in the royal palace. Train these young men in the language and literature of Babylon. The king assigned them a daily ration of food and wine from his own kitchens. They were to be trained for 3 years, and then they would enter the royal service. Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah were four of the young men chosen, all from the tribe of Judah. The chief of staff renamed them with these Babylonian names. Daniel was called Belshazzar, Hananiah was called Shadrach, Mishael was called Meshach, and Azariah was called Abednego. But Daniel was determined not to defile himself by eating the food and wine given to them by the king. He asked the chief of staff for permission not to eat these unacceptable foods. Now God had given the chief of staff both respect and affection for Daniel. But he responded, "I am afraid of my lord the king, who has ordered you to eat this food and wine. If you become pale and thin compared to the other youths your age, I am afraid the king will have me beheaded." Daniel spoke with the attendant who had been appointed by the chief of staff to look after Daniel, Hananiah, Meshach, and Azariah. "Please test us for 10 days on a diet of vegetables and water," Daniel said. "At the end of the 10 days, see how we look compared to the other young men who are eating the king's food. Then make your decision in light of what you see." The attendant agreed to Daniel's suggestion and tested them for 10 days. At the end of the 10 days, Daniel and his three friends looked healthier and better nursed than the young men who had been eating the food assigned by the king. So after that, the attendant fed them only vegetables instead of food and wine provided by the others. God gave these four young men an unusual aptitude for understanding every aspect of literature and wisdom. And God gave Daniel the special ability to interpret the meanings of visions and dreams. When the training period ordered by the king was completed, the chief of staff brought all the young men to the king Nebuchadnezzar. The king talked to them, and no one impressed him as much as Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. So they entered the royal service. Whenever the king consulted them in any matter requiring wisdom and balanced judgment, he found them 10 times more capable than any other magicians and enchanters in his kingdom. Daniel remained in the royal service until his first year of the reign of King Cyrus.
Thank you, Tim. All right, so we're reading a story here, and we find, I want to tell you the history bit of it about the story before we get into it, because sometimes in order to understand what's going on, you need to understand what previously happened. So, I don't actually believe, we're going to be looking at the history of Israel, and I don't believe in, like, things could be, like objects could be a Christian. I don't believe in, like, a Christian country, or I don't believe in, you know, a Christian, I mean, we have a Christian bookstore in Oakville, but I think that is, I think that's like a bookstore run by Christians. They sell Christian literature, and most of their content, the people who buy stuff there, are usually Christians. But I think the closest thing we could find to a Christian nation would have been Old Testament Israel. So Israel before Jesus, that would have been the closest thing to a Christian nation. But it wouldn't have actually been Christian, it actually would have been Jewish. But they were the people of God, so I guess you can, I don't want to say Christian, but they were the people of God. And now the reason that Israel could have been a Christian nation or a Jewish nation, or the people of God, is because God entered into a covenant with these people. Now, covenant, I had no idea what that meant. I had to study that. The word covenant just means like a promise, a treaty, like a contract, a deal. But it's like a big binding deal. So God talked to Moses, and he told Moses that he made a covenant with Moses. It's called the Mosaic Covenant. In this covenant, God said to Moses, "You, Israel, will be my people, and I will be your God." It's almost like they're building this relationship where we have a God now, and he has a people. And this is why they are the people of God. And Israel had three markers that kind of identified them as the people of God. And the first thing was their land. Israel was given this land as a gift from God. They exited out of slavery, and God said, "I have a land for you, you're going to live in. You're my people. You're going to settle there." So the first thing was the land. The second thing was the temple. Sometimes people talk about the temple. The temple was the place in Israel where God, he lived. Now, I know that God can't be contained to a building. That'd be kind of silly, but the Bible even talks about how the heavens can't contain God. How can a building built by people contain God? But in the Old Testament, God had a dwelling place inside the temple, and then once a year, the high priest would come and he would take the sacrifice and he would atone for the sins of Israel. And this place that he would come to was called the Holy of Holies, and that's where God, that's where his presence was like manifested there. And the temple was like the central place of worship where people would come, offer sacrifice. So the temple is very important. That's kind of a marker that we are the people of God. We have our temple, which our God lives in. And the third thing is their king. Now, the king was very, very symbolic to Israel. God made a promise that through the king's lineage, there would always be someone ruling on the throne. And then through the king, there'd be one person who would, Jesus eventually, he would be the one to actually build a kingdom that would endure forever. So what this did was it gave Israel confidence in their future. And how sweet is that to know that you know that your future is secure? Now, I want to ask, doesn't this just sound like the best place ever? You know, you go there, you know, God lives there, God dwells there. The whole place is structured around worship. It's designed to, you know, be in relationship with God. You know, it's socially acceptable to be the people of God there. No one's going to hate on you or make fun of you or tease you because it's just the people of God. It'd be amazing to live there. And the only place I can think of that's comparable to that would actually probably be places like this building. We come here and it's socially acceptable to be a Christian here. We love one another. We worship together. And, you know, we come here and I really think that when we have times of music and community, I really think that God shows up and in the sense that he really encourages the heart that needs encouraging but the fact that God kind of responds to what we do, it's this interaction. Like this place is like probably the safest place and the easiest place to be a Christian. It's when we go out of here, it's tough. You know, I meet with my students and, you know, one question I'll generally ask them is, how's your prayer life doing? I'm like, if I go to Zaire's, no one's going to ask me that question. It's like, they don't care. And I don't blame them. I don't know why they would care. So, now, I told you we're going to talk about the story here. So, everything that happened, Israel lives in this wonderful utopia. It's a wonderful place. And they did have the rebellion, but they lived in a good place. And then what happened is that they went into exile. They went back into slavery because of their rebellion. So, you got to say goodbye to this beautiful land because they're going into slavery again. And that's where the story picks up. So, in this new land where people don't care about, it's just like I go to Zaire's, people don't really, they're not interested in my faith. They don't care about our church culture here at all. My worship towards God, it doesn't impact them. So in this story, Daniel is in a new land, there's a new king, there's a new central religion. There isn't any kind of structure that supports his faith at all. And they don't want to hear about his God because really, Babylon destroyed Israel. Therefore, they're thinking, the God of Babylon must be greater than the God of Israel because they're taking artifacts out of his temple and putting it in their own. Like, they humiliated Israel. So, Daniel's in this new land where, you know, they don't acknowledge his God. And the thing that's happening here is that Daniel needs to be afraid of is that now that he no longer lives in Israel, you know, will this relationship you have with God start to be fading out. The same way that I'm not really that tied to my, West Indian roots. Will that happen? And another example of that, growing up in my parents' house, we watched the Blue Jays. Any Blue Jays fans? Yeah, Blue Jays. Okay, so we would watch the Blue Jays game, usually during dinner and go after dinner, and we'd just sit on the couch. My dad and I would talk baseball, and it was fun. But ever since I moved out of my parents' house, like, I haven't seen a game in, like, I don't even know how the Blue Jays are doing. And apparently my dad told me that they don't even know what they're doing, so. But the point is, though, like, the Blue Jays have been phased out of my life because I just don't live at home anymore, the place where I'd actually watch the game. So in Daniel's case right here, the culture is attempting to phase God out of him. We know that nothing could separate us from the love of God, but the challenge for Daniel is that will God be separated from the love of Daniel because of the culture? It's a bit different there. So I want to take a look at this. In verse 4, it says that they gave Daniel a new literature to study, a new language to learn, a new name, a new diet, and he lived in a culture that worshipped a different god. Now, I want to take a close look. Like, this is the verse I would brush over, but I don't want to brush over it. He had to learn a new literature for 3 years. So imagine it, it's like going to college. And he would be enrolled in Babylonian studies. And Babylonian studies, I mean, I had to look it up and figure out what kind of stuff Daniel would be learning, but Babylonian studies, he'd have to be aware of sorcery, divination, how to read omens, interpret unusual terrestrial astrology. These are the things he had to be good at. Like, that's scary. I'm glad they didn't teach me that in seminary. But Daniel had to be excellent in things that are dark and sinful. Things that I would never engage in. And this is what the culture tried to do to Daniel. We want to indoctrinate you almost, reprogram you. Now, it's dangerous to be reprogrammed when you don't know what you're being reprogrammed with. Now, in the Bible, there's a story of Abraham and Lot in Genesis. And the story of Abraham and Lot, they had a lot of money, like a lot of wealth. So one day they have a lot of wealth and they realize that their servants are fighting because they have too much to manage. Now, when you have servants who are fighting because there's too much to manage, that's a rich person problem. Okay, you're loaded. Like, that's something I won't deal with. I don't know. That's a rich people problem. And what happened is they talked about it and they came to some conclusion. Okay, you know, the land's bigger. Let's just spread out. And Abraham offered Lot the first pick. Where do you want to go? You go anywhere in Israel. Where do you want to go? And Lot says, I'm going to go over there. And the place over there was near Sodom. Now, Sodom and Gomorrah, maybe that comes up in pop culture. Sodom was the most evil place. Jesus even says he recognizes it. Like, that place is evil. And they did some messed up stuff there. But Lot picks his place by Sodom. 5 chapters later in Genesis, 5 chapters later in Genesis, Lot is approached in Sodom, and we see that he's actually the gatekeeper of Sodom. You know, at first he was just around the area. 5 chapters later, he's the gatekeeper. You're like, what happened between then and now? That's, and it's nothing wrong with being a gatekeeper. Probably full job. But what happens is that Lot actually, he didn't live around the, like, outside of the culture. He lived inside Sodom. And we realize that Lot picked up some very, very dark practices. Embrace yourself, I'll just say it. But the practice he picked up, well, the practice that, the result of it, he impregnated both his daughters. So some messed up stuff. And you know what? That's not too strange for Sodom. So it's dangerous when you are being reprogrammed by a culture. I'm not saying this culture is going to do that. In fact, I'll address that after. But you spend enough time in a culture, you start to adapt some practices. You start to lose some practices. And I'm not going to be here saying the world's an evil place. That's not what I'm talking about today. So if you expected that. But there is a danger in taking on the culture's ways when you're not completely aware of what it is we take on and where we live. And this isn't really new to us. I think that when we have our children, we send them to school, and we say, hey, you know, don't make friends with so-and-so, make friends with good kids, and we teach our kids to make wise decisions. And that's because we don't want our children getting mixed up in the bad. I mean, we have kids, we probably said that once or twice. I don't have kids. But the Bible even says, you know, bad company corrupts good character. It's important to pick good friends. So we know that being reprogrammed by a culture is a dangerous thing. But we want to find out, what is the culture reprogramming with? So the culture we experienced was probably a lot different than Daniel's culture. In Daniel's culture, we'll see a couple chapters later, if he worshipped his God, he could have died for it. In our culture, we live in Canada, and Canada is, you know, land of the free, we don't have that problem. But do you know what the major religion in Canada is? It's, you know, not every religion has a god. Like Buddhism, I'm not too skilled in that religion, but they don't have a god. It's not a god they worship. The major religion in Canada is actually, here's a mouthful for ya, secular humanism. And secular humanism is the practice that we could find the fullness of life apart from God. And that's why the world is comfortable practicing, actually I'll explain how we got there. So 500 years ago, the church was the center of culture. It was like, Christianity was like the dominant religion. And then we entered into this age called the Age of Enlightenment. And the Age of Enlightenment, in the 1700s and 1800s, everything was challenged. If things didn't go through science, the scientific method, if it couldn't be proven by science, then it would be invalid. So a lot of the Bible got pushed aside, because scientifically you cannot prove someone walking on water, someone turning water to wine, raising the dead, these things, it's just, you wouldn't find, like, it's not, you can't prove it. That's why they're called miracles. But a lot of the Bible got pushed aside, and Christianity no longer became, like, the dominant religion. And people started saying, well, when God gets pushed to the side, people started trying to find the fullness of life outside of God. And that's why people are more comfortable exploring sexuality. You know, they don't need to, like, sorry, I lost my spot here. People, they're comfortable exploring sexuality. You know, why put a limit on it? Why not just figure out as much as you can and maybe you'll find fullness there? They do that in attempts to find life, joy, happiness. But it's not just, you know, sexuality. It's have as much fun as you can. Find all the limits. Figure out what works. You know, in a world like this, you know, watch whatever you want, do whatever you want, go wherever you want, spend money on whatever you want. In this world, money, power, and sex are like the three, like, gods of this culture. Because it's the belief that these things will bring us wholeness, happiness, like the most kind of fun you can have in life, not fun, the most fulfilling life you can have, it's believed that you'll find it in these three things. And so secular humanism is all about saying that we could find wholeness apart from God. And I'm here to tell you today, I don't think that's possible. I think the wholeness, if you want to live the most full life possible, it's actually found in knowing God and being known by God and having this relationship with God. But the world would look at Christianity and think it's irrelevant because we can find sex to the joys, like the joy of sex. We say that the fullness of it is found in two people in a post-relationship, male and female. And the world would say, no, that's, so why would you put yourself in a box? They would explore that. They would go further. Or they wouldn't put a limit on things. But we know that, I mean, because God has taught us that the fullness of joys is actually in following his ways. What he has set out, we would follow. So yeah, Christianity might seem a bit more relevant to people out there. I don't really know that many popular Christians. Joyce Myers is a big name. The Pope. Two, okay. But we're taught that also power is something that we don't lord it over people. Jesus teaches us there's more joy in life in actually being a servant. And we know that earning money isn't everything either, because like there's no point in like working like an 18-hour day, like, because money isn't the god. We know that money doesn't bring happiness. In fact, we're called to take our money and actually be generous with our money, to look to the needs of others. Jesus teaches that there's more life in that. So what we learn is it's very different. A little while ago, on the May 2-4 weekend, Lauren was at she was at work and she was in the break room. And I'm sure we've all had experience like this before. She's in the break room and people are talking about what they're gonna do over the long Victoria Week holiday. And like Lauren was like, oh, they're like, we're gonna get drunk, we're gonna drink so hard, carpooling ways, like, okay, well, you drive, we'll go there and we'll pick up all the stuff. And it came to Lauren. And they're like, Lauren, what are you going to do? And Lauren's like, well, on Saturday, I'm going to be teaching an ESL class. on Sunday, we're going to a wedding, and Sunday I'm going to church. That was a fun weekend, too. I enjoyed that weekend. But it was like dropping like a pin, like, oh, okay. And we've all been there, and yeah. I've been in those awkward conversations, too, where I'm going to church this Sunday. Does anyone want to come with me? So we know that following God and... Okay, I'm going to go off script for a sec. I talked a couple weeks ago, or January 22nd, I preached a sermon, and I talked about the fullest life we can have is in knowing Jesus and being known by Jesus. And I talked about why the Christian life is so valuable. And the three reasons why there is more life in Christianity than there is anywhere else in the world is because when we know God, He gives us new life. He gives us forgiveness. He gives us all these things, a love that we can never find anywhere else in the world, as deep as His, we'll find in Him. That's the first reason. The second reason is because we find forgiveness for everything we've done. We can find forgiveness in Jesus. And the third reason is because when we follow Jesus, He gives us purpose for our life. And I've had days where I've just been like, you know, I don't have purpose. I'm not following God. But when I'm following God, He gives me a sense of mission. And I don't know if you know what it's like to feel kind of like, I don't know what I'm doing. But when you have that mission on your life and God's got a plan for you and you're aware of that plan, there's nothing better than living that life. Okay, I'm coming back here now. So, this is why Christianity is worth giving yourself to. But how do we resist being reprogrammed by a culture? You know, secular humanism, how do we protect from that? Well, action reinforces memory. So we look at this text here, we look at the Bible, and it says that Daniel chose not to take the food and the wine. So we don't know if the wine and the food was actually, you know, defiled. Paul talks in the New Testament saying, you know, don't eat food offered to idols. But we read in the next book of the Bible, Nehemiah, that Nehemiah was the cupbearer to the king, so he had to drink wine. Part of his job. Some people would love that job. We don't know if this food and wine was actually defiled. I mean, I can't guarantee. I don't know what this food and wine was offered for. But, I mean, maybe it was. But there's something bigger going on here. When Daniel consciously decides not to eat the food and wine, drink the food and wine, consume the food and wine, every time he does that, he's acknowledging that Jesus is Lord. God is Lord. God is my God. See, every time Daniel would eat, you know, maybe three times a day, he would eat his vegetables and drink his water, he would be consciously taking an action that said, that made him reflect on God, that made him acknowledge God. I do this for you. This is my offering to you. I do this for you. It's almost like the action that he did reinforced his memory three times a day. So how do we remember God in a world that attempts to erase God? Not erase, but phase out. It's like it just falls off. Well, we need to tie action together with knowing. And there are many ways we do that, whatever the action is. For this week, I decided to go for a prayer walk. You know, left my phone at home. And you just go for a while, and the intention is to get away and pray. I was taught another practice at 3 o'clock in the day, 3 o'clock just because it's the busiest time of day for me, stop what I'm doing and take 1 minute to thank God. Growing up, I was taught, learn to pray before a meal. These are practices that we put in our way. We actually put obstacles in our way to make us reflect on God. I know we live in a culture where we want to just get all the obstacles out of the way and do whatever, but these obstacles are actually good for us. My dad told me that what his practice is that every day he shaves in the morning, and he actually says this verse in his head, you know, Daniel purposed in his life not to defile himself. And my dad says, you know, while shaving every morning, you know, I'm not going to do that, God. You know, God, I live in a world where I have so many demands on me from my work, from what's good, what's right to do from you. You know, how am I going to do good? But that's what my dad does. So every day when he shaves, and he shaves every day, so he has to actually do this action. He put a roadblock in front of him, an obstacle. So my challenge for us today is that we need to be making obstacles in our way that would help us reflect on God. And I want to just, I'm not going to say do these three things, but I'm going to say these are three things that we should consider. And the first thing is what we do in church. So I think going to church is super, super important. I know a lot of people say you don't need to go to church to be a Christian. I agree with you. But I do believe that when we start putting off our gatherings together, we start putting off other things too. Thank you. Yes. So going to church, I mean, I think everyone here is doing a great job. So, all y'all. The second thing I would suggest too is, if you're not involved in like a small group or something, I would say get involved with one. You know, we're here and we have Sunday gatherings, and that's good. We are, you know, but I want to be more than a Sunday Christian. I want to be like a 7-day Christian. And going to small groups or getting together with people in the week, those are things that help us. Those are things that help us to stay in community. These are good things that we put in our way. And the third thing is we got to get involved in serving ministries, because this is literally action we do. So I would say find out what your gifts are, and I would even say find out what, you know, we look at this church, if there's something you think we could do better, that's something that you'd want to take initiative in, send me an email. I was going to say talk to me, but I can't handle everyone at once. Send us an email, and we're going to look at what we can do to make, like, to help you get plugged in. Maybe you want to help with the food bank. Maybe you want to help in the Sunday service. That's great. Whatever your gifts are, let us know, and we'll find out how we can come alongside and help you. And the last thing is, you know, we have a library outside, and there are so many, like, summertime, sometimes things slow down in the summer. There are some great books on that shelf that I wish were on my shelf. Go take a look after the service and see if there's anything that you would want to maybe just read. But connect, find an action that will tie knowing God into, that'll help you connect with God. Whether it's, you know, for me, I actually have to stop grabbing my phone. Whenever I grab my phone, it's because I want a quick fix, something just to look at to entertain me for 15 seconds. But I started putting my phone down and saying, okay, well, I'm going to, I have 15 seconds, let's pray. Yesterday, Lauren and I were cleaning up, or Friday, and I was mopping the floor, and I was waiting for the floor to dry so I can go to the other spot. And what I did was, I just instead of going to my phone to spend time doing whatever while the floor dried, I spent time in prayer, and that may have been the best part of my day. Just like, not even a minute, maybe 2 minutes. So lastly, I just want to look at the outcome of this passage. Daniel gave to God with what little he had. I don't think he had much power in his life in this position. You know, he's going to be beheaded the next chapter. We'll find out next Sunday if he didn't do something. So he lives in a strict environment. But the one thing he had power over, he used it to honor God with. And it says in verse 17 that Daniel and his friends did 10 times better than everyone else. It also says that God gave Daniel the gift of interpreting dreams, which, yeah, we'll talk about next week as we get into that. So I just want to encourage you, whatever, you know, you have, whatever it is you, whatever you can give or whatever you can put in your life, I don't hear stories about people saying, you know, I made more time for God in my life and it was a bad decision. I hear the opposite. So I'm going to look at some text messages. You text in, I have a few. I love that point that nothing could separate Daniel from the love of God. But could a culture separate God from the love of Daniel? That's a great point. Yeah, I think that's really cool. Is there a way for us to help others pursue applications? Sorry. Is there a way for us to help others pursue the application section suggestions? Talk to me in the week. Send me an email. I'm not quite sure what that means. How do we best address people in the culture that believe that success, power, and money give them fulfillment? Like coworkers, friends, and family? That's a good question. Well, I don't think that... Last week, Craig talked about the ethics and how we would actually go address people. I don't think just kind of... I mean, if you're to tell people all the time, you should come to church with me, you should come to church with me, you should come to church with me, they would be annoyed at me really fast. I think that the way that we would let people see that that money isn't the God, money, sex, and power aren't gods, is that if we live in a way that would be attractive to them. I believe there's a old Christian, one of the church fathers said that we preach the gospel at all times, and if necessary, use words. I really like that. I think there's a place for words, but I think that people will see that the way we live is attractive, and they'll be more interested and be like, okay, well, maybe there is something about maybe teaching an ESL class or, you know, going to church on a Sunday. So can we all stand? And I would like to invite the worship team back up.